At Farm to Table, we know how confusing healthcare is. We're here to simplify the healing process. We believe that healthcare should be simple. It should help people feel better. That's why we started the Table Talk podcast, to gather around the table with you, no matter where you are. We want to come and learn together and discuss a new healthcare approach that addresses the root cause of your symptoms. The journey for each person is unique, but together we can thrive.
All right. Well, welcome to the Table Talk podcast. And today we have a really exciting special guest, and I am excited. She has done some amazing continuing education work for us this year for our pharmacists that are part of our annual pass and on our website, functionalmedicineCE.com. But welcome, Dr. Pisano. She is a doctor of clinical nutrition, and she has really had a wide range of practice in both personal practice and academia, specializing in nutritional genomics and metabolomics. And really, one of the reasons why we're having this conversation today is she is a specialist in mast cell disorders, as well as connective tissue diseases such as Ehlers-Danlos syndrome and dysautonomias and autoimmune disease. So we're really excited to pick your brain, because I think a lot of these conditions are becoming more prevalent, maybe, or just more recognized maybe than they were before. So tell us a little bit about how you got into this and a little bit more about your background.
Absolutely. So years ago, I'd already been in practice for a while, and I was actively working on a master's degree in nutrition and found myself having lots of health challenges. At first, it was just some strange GI symptoms, and it sort of evolved into this very large allergic kinds of symptoms. Nobody could figure out what it was. Eventually, I started to figure out what was going on in my body. And that was around the time that I was diagnosed with Ehlers-Danlos syndrome and a mast cell activation syndrome. Because of the fact that I had these conditions, I ended up on a lot of discussion boards and things for patients, because I was.
Sure.
But it seemed that people sort of figured out that I was also a nutrition practitioner. And so people started coming to me. And so I spent a lot of time doing research and learning about these conditions and trying to figure out how to get people feeling better. And so, sort of serendipity, I fell into this area. I'd been working with autoimmune diseases and mood disorders prior to that, and it was certainly a personal interest. And so I've over time evolved to have a large practice working with this patient population with multiple providers.
That's awesome. I love hearing that, because I think so often functional integrative medicine providers end up specializing in something that is personal to them, whether it was their own health journey or a journey of a family member or someone that they, you know, are really close to. But part of it is because when you're taking care of yourself, you're just like really all in, like you have to figure this out and you have to take care of that and of one person. And then once you have all the knowledge, you're like, wow, I got to share this with the world and share what I've learned. And it is obviously a journey, obviously, for everybody continuing. So that's really amazing that you're able to now use that for patient care. So tell us a little bit about what the patient that is coming to your practice. So you guys have a practice that is called Mast Cell Advanced Diagnostics, correct?
I do. It's actually two practices. That's my personal practice. And then I have a shared integrative practice with an immunologist, Dr. Ann Maitland, who also specializes in mast cell disorders and connective tissue disease. And we work together and collaborate on patient care.
Okay, awesome. And what is the patient that is coming to either one of those practices look like? What are the symptoms that they're experiencing? And I guess, what is that clinical presentation piece?
Absolutely. So on the mast cell side of the equation, they are probably coming in perhaps not really knowing what's going on specifically, but having symptoms that are along the lines of GI issues, oftentimes diarrhea, sometimes alternating with constipation, a lot of bloating. They will have more traditional allergic symptoms. They may have sinusitis kinds of symptoms, stuffy congestion, sneezing. They may have asthmatic kinds of challenges. They probably are having some flushing and redness. They may have, you know, thinking they're having a lot of food sensitivities, some of which may even be borderline food allergy or even fully anaphylactic. It really depends on the individual because mast cell can cause so many different symptoms, and some of which they may associate with something that feels allergic, and some of them might feel more like anxiety and mood issues that happen, but they're unpredictable. Sometimes they feel really calm and happy, and other times things can shift. So there's really a diverse array of symptoms that go along with this condition.
Sure, sure. And I think that makes it hard because a lot of functional integrative medicine providers are like not able to pinpoint that's what it could be contributing from, but they've sort of tried all of the other things. And oftentimes do you find that the patients are sort of have been working on trying to figure this out for a long time?
Absolutely. I would say that the vast majority of individuals with these disorders may see 10 or more providers before they find something that helps to solve the puzzle for them. And even then, a lot of times it's, I think this might be going on, but I'm not comfortable diagnosing it. So you need to find somebody who can actually work. Even for me, I mean, my first stop was a really good local gastroenterologist who did a huge amount of workup on me, eventually did endoscopy and colonoscopy, of which the only thing he could tell me is internally you have hives, you need a really good immunologist. He wasn't wrong, but there really wasn't any actionable items that came out of that. And honestly, I got into care quickly because I did my own research and figured it out. But most people don't have that luxury. And so they're really trying to figure out what's going on in their health and looking for a health partner to help them navigate it because it's difficult.
Yeah. So when they come to your office, what does the workup then look like to determine what type of condition in that mast cell spectrum, or if you want to talk about the different things that you're looking for in someone?
We have a team approach to care because these patients tend to be complex, and we can talk about mast cell as the primary today, but it's not actually typically primary in their health. Usually it's either immunodeficiency or connective tissue disease, of which hypermobile ileal stromal syndrome is the most common. So they come in and they usually start with a two-part intake, the first of which is an environmental and mind-body intake that's done by our Jamie, who works for me. She's a social worker. Because the environment very much influences symptoms, and we can work with them on some of the basics like air purification, water purifiers, making sure they're not having chemicals in their environment that are making them more prone to having symptoms. She also works up a lot of the mind-body aspects of things because mood can be such a big piece of this, as well as medical PTSD. I mean, some of these patients have really been through a lot trying to find what the answers are. And then they will, from there, they'll have a second appointment that will be with a master's level nutrition provider who starts to kind of put some of the pieces together and work on the dietary aspects, because usually food sensitivities are a big part of the equation and they're really adept at working with that. Mm-hmm. From there, we get into more specialized care, and they'll typically either work with myself or with Dr. Greer on our team. We help to continue the nutrition aspects, but also coordinate care, help get them to appropriate diagnoses and treatments for their conditions. And so that might include a workup for connective tissue disease. We might be looking at autoinflammatory issues. We might be working on immunodeficiency kinds of assessments, particularly mannose binding lectin deficiency, which can cause mast cell, and really honing in on things like nutritional genomics and metabolomics, which might explain what foods may be better tolerated and how do we fix the biochemistry, because we don't want to remove foods from the diet for long because that's not a healthy way to live. And so we work through all these pieces together, and we do have my practice partner, Dr. Maitland, who is a MD, PhD immunologist specializing in this area. And we're actually about to bring in late September, a nurse practitioner also specializing in immunology and has been working with mast cell patients for quite some time. That's Erin Kolb. So we have a lot of ability to run appropriate diagnostics and treat, but we're also working from a functional medicine standpoint while most people with mast cell issues do require some level of medication, lifestyle, botanicals, things that natural mast cell stabilizers, things like luteolin in routine, use of nutrients that help with histamine breakdown, vitamin C and riboflavin and vitamin B6 can be really helpful for these patients. And sometimes in the beginning, they're better tolerated than medications are. And so, you know, it becomes a way to get them to a point where we can actually take them that step further and get them to a medication that might really stabilize their symptoms. And so it's really complex. It's about a lot of what I call medical advocacy, because even with our large group and lots of different types of providers, these patients often need to see doctors outside of our practice. And so it's coordinating, trying to find care for them either close to home or with, if it needs to be a specialist that's further away, facilitating referrals and making sure that there's collaboration so these patients aren't getting lost in the system and their needs are being met.
Sure, that makes a ton of sense. And I love like the integrative approach of like, if we do need medications, we have the appropriate providers for that, but that we also can bring in this nutrition and functional piece to really, like you said, optimize the physiology. So can you tell us a little bit about like what's actually happening in the body in these patients regarding like the histamine and the mast cells and like what is that connection to the connective tissue dysfunction?
Absolutely. So let's start off with the basics of what a mast cell is, because a lot of people don't know what they are. And so they're part of our immune system, and particularly what we call our innate immune system, meaning it's what we're born with. It functions from the day we're born and doesn't have any memory. And mast cells are what we call a sentinel cell. They're kind of soldiers. They sit on the periphery of our body and they guard us. That could be from a bacteria or virus or fungal kind of infection that comes through. But their other big role that people really associate them with is allergy, because sometimes they get a little too crazy and they start defending us against things that are actually not a problem, like pollen. Typically, sometimes food allergies can develop because of mast cells, and they bring in immunoglobulins to help them. Now, immunoglobulins have memory and they therefore are our bigger defense. In the case of allergy, they can recruit IgE. And so we can get true allergic responses. This is a typical allergy scenario. In mast cell activation syndrome, what's happening is that the mast cells are overactive and they're responding too often, not to a typical allergy or even an infection necessarily. They just keep triggering when we don't need to be having these symptoms. And so the patient is having all sorts of flushing and food intolerances and environmental intolerance and things going on. The connection to the connective tissue, which is really important because I would say the vast majority of patients who are experiencing mast cell symptoms have a connective tissue disease, whether it be a genetic one like Ehlers-Danlos syndrome or something that's more autoimmune like mixed connective tissue disease or lupus. These patients, they have this connective tissue that's unstable. And the mast cells are living directly in that tissue. And so they're being destabilized by the tissue. So because of the instability of their environment, they become a little bit more likely to respond. And so they kind of keep firing and firing, again, at benign things that they don't need to be concerned. The other way it can happen, and sometimes this happens in conjunction with the connective tissue disease, is there can be immunodeficiencies. And so what happens is the mast cell tries to bring in help and the help doesn't respond. And so the mast cell is sort of, I always liken them to, you know, a young 18, 19-year-old who decides they're going to join the Marines. They go through their boot camp. They're sent off to the front lines of the war. And their commanding soldiers see, hey, we've got new people. We're going to go take a break because we're exhausted. But you're going to man this area that's kind of scary, that's got all this firing going on. And that kid's going to keep shooting at anything that moves because they're going to be scared out of their mind. And that's sort of what happens when the mast cells don't get a response from other parts of the immune system. They don't have any mechanism of making a decision or remembering, hey, this isn't a problem, or, oh, this is something I really need to respond to. And so it just keeps firing and causing unnecessary symptoms for the individual.
Sure. And how does autoimmunity play into that? Because some of these patients also have autoimmunity, or they end up having an autoimmune mast cell or attack on the mast cells?
Yeah. So we have two kinds of autoimmune. There's the type that's going to destabilize the connective tissue that we sort of addressed. But for some patients, they don't actually have mast cell activation syndrome, while they have all the symptoms. What they actually have is a condition called autoimmune urticaria. And that basically is a condition where the body is attacking the IgE receptor. And it tends to cause very, very high IgE levels. And it therefore causes these pseudoallergies, but through the IgE mechanism. So while it seems from a lab work standpoint to be very different from a mast cell activation syndrome, the symptoms are almost identical. The treatments overlap greatly. I think the biggest difference is there's a biologic called Xolair that tends to be really helpful for autoimmune urticaria. But in general, the overarching symptoms, presentation, and treatment pathway is going to be quite similar.
Okay. And as far as medications go, you talked about Xolair being one that's used often. What other things are you guys typically layering on to help stabilize the mast cells?
The most basics are actually available by and large over the counter. They're antihistamines. So your typical would for emergency might be something like Benadryl. To stabilize longer term, you might use medications like Claritin or Zyrtec, Zizol. These tend to be really helpful. And that's defending our H1 receptor. So histamine that is causing more traditional allergic responses, that your stuffy nose, hay fever kinds of symptoms, as well as hives and rashes. The GI side of the equation is our histamine 2 receptor, H2, and that's going to be medications like Pepcid or Tagmet, both of which are available over the counter. And so that's our mainstay in terms of, hey, these are the basics that we start with. There are other medications, mast cell stabilizers like Cromolyn sodium and Ketotifen that are prescription. Sometimes they'll use Montelukast, which is also known as Singulair, and that can be helpful for people who are having respiratory-based symptoms. There are other kinds of medications, but those are the basics that we would consider before moving into something larger like a Xolair that's a biologic. Sometimes they'll use Dupixent also as a biologic, but by and large, most patients aren't requiring that level of treatment.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting, the Ketotifen, because like commercially, it's only available for an eye drop over the counter, but you guys are actually using that orally, right, as compounds?
Yeah, you have to compound it. It is available through many compounding pharmacies. Again, not my go-to as a mast cell stabilizer. It's actually a combination of an H1 blocker, so an antihistamine plus mast cell, and it is anticholinergic. So in really bad cases, we will sometimes bring it on board, but something like a Cromolyn sodium that only has 1% absorption but helps whatever tissue needs to be stabilized is often a better option. It's particularly helpful either orally for GI-based issues like diarrhea or for some of the mast cell-triggered breathing issues. Nebulized Cromolyn can be really helpful at stabilizing respiratory symptoms, much better than traditional allergy medications like albuterol when it's being caused by a mast cell problem. There's also nasal Crom, which is available over the counter. It's the same product and also really helpful for sinus symptoms and frankly, fantastic for itching and hives topically.
I heard that on the CE. I thought that was really interesting. So if like right when the hive presents, you put it on top or you'd use it as a preventative for hives?
Both, actually. So for people who have a lot of skin-based symptoms like hives, we'll have them use it 4 times a day because it prevents the mast cells in the skin from degranulating because skin itself is connective tissue. And so a lot of times you get that. In fact, one of the hallmark signs of somebody who has mast cell issues is called dermatographism, which is literally translates into skin writing, where if you scratch yourself, you get this raised red welt that develops. And it's basically a large hive wheel. So if you stabilize the skin, you get less of that occurring.
Super interesting. So do you compound it in a lotion or a spray, or they just use the OTC like nasal spray on their hands?
OTC works quickly, and it's got minimal compounding ingredients, so most people tolerate it well. Sometimes we will actually have them combine it with other ingredients. And so what I usually have people do is like a quarter cup of whatever lotion they tolerate, and then add in cromlin, and then we might add in other things like luteolin and rutin, which can be helpful. Sometimes I'll use another PEA, can be helpful as well. That's technically a natural H2 blocker, but it also really helps stabilize mast cells, really helpful for itching and hives and eczema that occur in mast cell patients.
Yeah, I feel like PEA is making a comeback because obviously there's like the pain data, like from a while ago, but then during COVID, it was part of a lot of protocols because of that like cytokine storm piece thing, and probably related to some of that mast cell stabilization too.
Exactly. It's basically, it has two functions. It's an H2 blocker, so it's stabilizing the histamine 2 receptors in the gut, but it also prevents the mast cells from triggering substance P that causes pain. And it's doing so by controlling cytokines. And so it does have a huge potential in terms of really helping people's symptoms. Works beautifully for pain as well, associated with neuropathies, people who are having neuropathic issues, hands, feet, wherever. Applying as part of a cream, as well as oral use, can be really helpful. And the interesting thing is, not everybody's going to tolerate it orally in this population, but the topical I tend to find universally well tolerated.
What do you think it is about the oral is it triggering something that's maybe just allergic to it, or?
I'm not seeing major allergic symptoms with it. I have seen strong shifts in mood and just overall immune-based kinds of issues, not necessarily allergic, but it might be pushing a little too hard on decreasing histamine. And because histamine itself is a neurotransmitter, it interacts with many of the other ones. And so if you already have particular presentation and medications and supplements on board, it may just be too much for an individual.
Yeah. Yeah. Super interesting. Well, you mentioned the histamine is a neurotransmitter there. So talk to me about like the comorbid anxiety and depression that you're seeing in patients with mast cell activation.
Absolutely. I mean, as a neurotransmitter, it controls so many aspects of how our nervous system works. It has a lot to do with memory and learning. It can be involved in our sleep-wake cycle. It can be involved in water balance. But it typically is going to, when levels are high, cause increased levels of excitatory neurotransmitters, things like norepinephrine and epinephrine, which are catecholamines that can cause what I call more of a mind spinning kind of anxiety. It's not a true panic attack, but the person who can't kind of get something out of their brain, same thing as noradrenaline and adrenaline. So these are our fight or flight neurotransmitters. You will find glutamate levels go higher in these patients. On the flip side, it tends to decrease our inhibitory or calming neurotransmitters, things like GABA and glycine and serotonin tend to go low. And so a lot of times you'll have these patients who are having severe shifts in their mood, which unfortunately will often be the first thing that's diagnosed for them. So instead of being diagnosed with a mast cell disorder or connective tissue disease or whatever else might be going on, they're getting a bipolar diagnosis or an anxiety diagnosis or depression diagnosis. And the problem is, once you're pigeonholed in that arena, they stop looking at medical and they just say, hey, this is a mood disorder and we need to do SSRIs or anti-anxiety medications and therapy, which addresses maybe a small piece of the puzzle. It's even tolerated for them, but it's not really what's going on.
Yeah. Oh man, we could go down a whole rabbit hole of all of the reasons people are offered SSRIs that are actually biochemistry things that we can address from a root cause standpoint. Interestingly, I had a patient friend that has Ehlers-Danlos, has mast cell actually, and I'm not sure if she ever got a full diagnosis of mast cell versus chronic, like the urticaria. She has responded really well to Xolair, but was put on an SSRI and like had serotonin syndrome from like a really, really small dose. And so I think that's like a really interesting thing listening to all of what you're talking about.
And the harder thing is the SNRIs, which they love to give our patients because they, it'll help with their pain level and maybe more effective than an SSRI for their mood, except holding norepinephrine around longer when you already have high levels tends to make the anxiety worse. And then it plays into another condition that we find in this population, which is dysautonomia and particularly postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome, or POTS, which is typically hyperadrenergic, meaning these catecholamines are already elevated. That's part of the problem. So it really can be catastrophic in this patient population to use an SNRI.
Yeah, that's super interesting. So from the anxiety perspective, like from a functional medicine standpoint, if we're not able to use medications, obviously addressing the histamine, but is there anything else that you guys are layering in? Other, obviously there's therapy and cognitive, those kinds of things, but what are your typical like nutritional or nutraceutical approaches there?
I mean, one is dialing back on histamine load in the diet. Low histamine diet really can be helpful, especially we tend to look at metabolomics to make sure that the pathway is actually a problem for somebody, because I don't like to pull foods if I don't have to from the diet that are healthy. But if it is, we pull back on dietary histamine, older meats, shellfish, certainly tomatoes and peppers and citrus, fermented foods. These things can be more triggering. So decreasing the histamine load, first step to do, and that really can be helpful. But from more of a botanical standpoint, there are things that we can use. I mentioned luteolin and rutin are great mast cell stabilizers. I will use quercetin sometimes, but not always. Quercetin is helpful, particularly for children, for postmenopausal women, and for males. I don't love using it for females of childbearing years in this patient population because they tend to be estrogen dominant. And quercetin itself is a catechol, and so it competes for breakdown with norepinephrine and epinephrine, as well as estrogen, which is a hormone catechol. So I find it tends to cause anxiety issues. L-theanine, which we typically use for anxiety, it also works as a natural antihistamine on top of controlling the anxiety. And that's because histamine and GABA look so similar biochemically that histamine can actually bind to the GABA receptor, blocking GABA, which is one of the reasons why it decreases GABA. So when we put in something that increases GABA, it also tends to decrease histamine load for patients as well as calm the anxiety. What I love about L-theanine, not just that it's readily available for people, but unlike a prescription benzodiazepine, which is highly addictive and will typically zonk you out for amount of time, the theanine is just enough to kind of dial it back. You can think straight. It's not addictive. You can drive a car. You can make a decision. If you're a parent, you can parent well on it. And we can use it, therefore, multiple times a day, not just to help in an emergency scenario, but to help control histamine and the anxiety that goes along with it. The other one that I really like is an adaptogenic herb called holy basil, which also has similar impact on our GABA levels and therefore is a natural antihistamine, but it also dials back on the catecholamines, which are produced by the adrenals. And so when we have more of that mind-spinning, ruminating kind of anxiety, that tends to be more of my go-to on that side of the equation.
Awesome. Super interesting. That quercetin piece is so interesting too, because I personally, like, until I was sitting in a lecture, and I think it was Jill Carnahan or someone was speaking about quercetin, and she was talking about it being a COMT, and she called it a COMT inhibitor, but you're saying maybe it's just competitive for COMT, and so that is causing it to sort of slow down at that enzyme. But I couldn't figure out why, like, some days coffee made me, like, really jittery, and some days it didn't. And then I was sitting there, and I was like, you know what? Some days I take this like allergy product with that in it, and some days I don't. And I think throughout the cycle too, like you're saying, like women, estrogen and progesterone being higher at different times, like it may impact you more in different areas of the cycle too. So I think that's just a perfect example of there's not a one size fits all approach when it comes to, same with drugs, but nutraceuticals and nutrition, and individualizing it to that person's genetics and what else is going on.
Absolutely. I think a lot of people feel like, oh, this is natural, therefore it's benign and anybody can take it. And I think that's a little bit misguided. We really need to be thinking, hey, these aren't controlled substances, so that, okay, is great, but we do want to use them for the right reason, at the right dosage, at the right time, because they can have side effects. They compete with medications for breakdown. So it's not uncommon for me to see somebody coming in on a supplement that maybe I might actually use sometimes with the patient, but they're on a medication that makes it contraindicated. They might have a similar impact, or they may compete for a particular enzyme for a breakdown where they can become toxic if you're taking both together. And so it's really important to work with somebody that knows these things before you start a botanical, or even sometimes vitamins and minerals at high doses can be problematic as well.
So to wrap it up here, can you just let our audience know what metabolomics is? Because I think that some of the people that are listening are like, I don't even know what that means. So tell us what that is and how that's different maybe than just the nutritional genomics.
Yeah, so metabolomics is a fancy term for looking at the biochemistry in the body. And we can do this from a variety of different types of testing. It can be as basic as looking at a complete blood count or a comprehensive metabolic panel, but it also can get much more complex. And we can use things like organic acids, amino acids, and fatty acids to really see what's going on at a biochemical level, which then can tell us what sort of nutritional solutions might work best for an individual. Nutritional genomics, on the other hand, is really looking at the genetics and how that might impact things like your biochemistry, how you might handle a particular nutrient. One of the common ways we can look at it is we were talking about coffee. So some people think about caffeine and they talk about it making them jittery. That's the ADORA2 gene. There's another one, CYP1A2, that's associated with increased risk of heart attack with more than 2 cups of coffee a day. So there are different things that kind of color how we eat. What metabolomics does is it shows us whether something is actually active and happening. And so that tends to be more so what we're looking at.
Yeah, I agree. It's nice to know your genetics, but like the genetics doesn't always play out depending on how things are being expressed. And so I would rather know like what's actually happening if I could choose, but it's great to know it all, right? But like if you can choose only one test, it's nice to know what's actually happening right now in the body, or what your new, like what your magnesium level actually is versus, oh, you're prone to magnesium deficiency.
Well, and somebody might assume just because they're having mast cell issues that they have something like the diamine oxidase variant that causes histamine intolerance, and they may not, but the pathway can still be impacted because histamine is high and you're using up the cofactors for that particular enzyme. And so looking at the metabolomics tells us what's actually happening and not just what might happen.
Yeah. Yeah. All these things are making me think my family has some kind of mast cell condition, but I know for sure we have DAO. I have DAO mutations. So maybe it is just more of that. But yeah, just thinking about my dad and like other things that have happened. And I'm like, the citrus definitely can be a trigger for me too. So maybe I need to talk to you, schedule an appointment. So speaking of that, how can people connect with your practice, and do you serve patients only in Virginia, or where all are you serving patients?
So on a nutrition side, we can really see patients pretty much any place. Medically, if Dr. Greer is actually licensed in, I think she's up to 14 states right now. We have most of the East Coast covered, as well as California, Illinois. She's licensed in Hawaii, randomly, she's licensed in. We had a patient with really high needs. Sometimes we'll add a licensure for a patient who's in an area like Hawaii where there's absolutely no medical care. She recently added Minnesota for the same reason. So we have that. Then there, Dr. Maitland is licensed in New York. She's licensed in Maryland and then in Utah. And then we have Erin, who's the nurse practitioner immunologist, who is licensed in Massachusetts, and adding before she fully onboards Vermont, Maine, New Hampshire, so all the New England states.
Yeah, well, definitely people can reach out to you. What is your website for them to find you?
Sure. So the easiest one to find us at is clinicalparadigms.com.
Okay, awesome. And then do you guys have any social media that you guys put out information that they can follow?
We do through Mast Cell Advanced Diagnostics. We have both Facebook and Instagram they can follow us at.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, anything else we forgot today that you would wanted to share?
I think it's just really important that if you feel like something like this is going on, to find a practice that really specializes in working with patients who can really assess you and see if this in fact is what's going on and see what might be driving it, because the mast cell issues are almost always secondary to something else. And we can't really get them fully controlled until we figure out what that is and get that part better controlled. So I would really point you in the direction of finding somebody who more specializes with this population versus just trying to work with a local allergist that may not really have enough information to get you where you need to be.
Yes, echo that. I know a lot of the labs that are very particular, a lot of general practitioners or even specialists like an immunologist might not usually run or know that you can send to the Mayo Clinic and like all of those kinds of things. So having the specialist is important. So, well, thank you so much for your time and just sharing this information to get more people education, and whether they're listening and they trigger, oh my goodness, this is me or this is my friend. So if you're listening and someone that this might be super helpful for, please share it with them as well. So thanks so much. And we'll talk to everyone next time.
Perfect. Thank you.
Bye.
Thanks for listening. We're excited you are on your journey with us. Find us online at farmtotable.life, farm with a P, and on Instagram at farmtotableteam.